This episode is brought to you by Harrah's Resort SoCal. Nestled against a rolling hillside and just down the road from Palomar Mountain, guests at Harrah's Resort SoCal can expect gorgeous views, friendly staff, available night and day to encourage everyone to have a great time. When I was there recently, I had a chance to dine at California's first and the nation's largest Hell's Kitchen. And it's true, the beef Wellington and sticky toffee dessert are great. The restaurant is inspired by the hit TV show and features a menu approved by the Michelin star celebrity chef, Gordon Ramsay himself. Hope to see you all at Harrah's Resort SoCal in 2024.
You have one unheard message.
Hi, I was calling Current, the influencer marketing platform, but I think I just got redirected to a bunch of people listening to a podcast. Well, anyways, I was calling Current because I was told they could help get my brand set up on TikTok Shop and even build out an affiliate program of content creators promoting my brand and even have those content creators go on live streams and promote my product there. Wow, I could really use Current. I also heard that the brands they work with are making millions in sales. I guess I'll just go to their website at current.tech.
I'm Derek Nguyen. I'm a writer, director, producer. I'm currently based in New York City, but I was born in Saigon and I grew up in Southern California. I've been living in New York since 1997.
Welcome to The Vietnamese. I'm your host, Kenneth Nguyen. Being part of a culture of nearly 100 million Vietnamese people in the world today comes with a lot of pain, proud history, and privilege. Join me as I highlight and explore the Vietnamese experience from all over the world.
What does it mean to be Vietnamese to you?
You know, that's a pretty heavy question, to be quite honest. I think that changes for me a lot every day, almost. You know, I think that what it means to be Vietnamese is also a reflection of how I see myself. You know, and it changes quite a bit, and how I feel about being Vietnamese is different from what I feel about it like 10 years ago than it's different than right. I feel now, you know. But I think that one of the things that really jumps out at me is, you know, it means to be creative, you know. I think that throughout history, Vietnamese people have had to be creative in order to survive, really, you know, whether it is through our storytelling or the creative ways to be innovative in, you know, and adjustable to the wars that have, you know, affected us, the colonialism that has affected us, and the migration to other places in the world, when, you know, some of us feel that our country disappeared, you know, after a war. So I find that, you know, the Vietnamese diaspora has really inspired me creatively. You know, a lot of my work has been informed by that, you know, and that inspiration and creativity has been something that that has been an endless supply of inspiration, you know. So yeah, I think for me, creativity really does float at the top of when I think about what it means to be Vietnamese, you know.
I had Ocean Vuong on a few weeks ago, and he said that parents' generation surviving is not an accident. You know, you just don't survive accidentally. There needs to be a lot of innovation and creativity involved in arriving or getting out of the country and, you know, making your way here and landing here and thriving here. Yeah. Takes a lot of creative juices.
Yeah. I mean, he's for one thing, he's incredible. I just love his work. And I think he's an incredible speaker. But it you know, one of the things that I think about when I think of creativity also is just like the oral traditions that we have, you know, and how we tell stories passed down from one generation to another. You know, I find that to be an inspiration, and why, you know, a lot of us need to tell these stories, you know. My grandmother was one of those people, you know. Oh, wow. She was one of the inspirations for my film, The Housemaid, you know, and she, so she's no longer with us, but I'm glad that she was able to tell these stories before she passed away, because those stories will be forgotten otherwise, you know. And that creativity, I feel that that's creative, you know. And, you know, my grandmother, I love her to death, but there's a fine line between what is real and what isn't. So, you know, and I think I hear that this is a Vietnamese thing, that, you know, the lines between what is real and what is fictional, or what is conjured, or what is, you know, memory is fluid a lot, you know, and you don't know exactly if it's what actually happened during a war and what was conjured, or a memory of something that could have happened, you know. So I find that to be creative and interesting, you know, and my work also deals with that a bit too. So
I wonder a lot about the generation that came out of Orange County at about our age, mm-hmm. and the creative class that comes out of Orange County, because if you think about the population, there should have been more, but obviously, you know, we were busy surviving and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And our parents were busy, you know, pushing other, career paths, which is completely understandable. But totally how did you get, you? Because you're not one of these young kids that have, you know, parents that that were open to doing whatever. You know, our generation's different. So I'm curious how you sort of escaped that that paradigm.
Right. Well, I didn't escape it. I actually applied to university in aerospace engineering. You know, I wanted to, go into space. I was really into, I went to space camp. I wanted to be an astronaut and all that stuff. But in high school, you know, I was really active in not only sports, but also theater and, you know, all of that type of stuff. And once I got to college, I soon realized that engineering was not my calling, you know, and it became very apparent very soon, you know, and I had to break it to my family, you know. I was like, this is not what I want to do. And they were resistant, you know, as any immigrant, you know, refugee family would, you know. I understand that, like, coming to this country took a lot of sacrifice in it, and, you know, the idea of having their son go into a career path that is very is not very stable, you know, was something that they were resistant of. But I think that once I started getting my work out there, they started to understand a little bit more, you know, and I started actually making money, which is something that they were really worried about. And I totally understand that, you know, and so they started to become more supportive of what I was trying to do. And interestingly, my family is actually pretty creative, you know. I have my sister was also in film, you know. I have a cousin that's a DIT in film, and so there's always there has been a creative streak in our family that in some ways is inescapable, I guess, you know. It was just kind of like in our DNA, I guess, you know.
Yeah. So, and that helps when there's like family. You said older sister or younger sister?
My younger sister, yeah. She actually went to Chapman University in film, you know, and so and worked at Sony for a while and everything. So we've all kind of been circling, and when you're not the only one, you don't feel so alone, right, in the family, and that other people are also, you know, pursuing, you know, creative aspirations and, you know, professions. And so the rest of the, you know, family is like, oh, well, yeah, you can actually make a decent living and you can actually do something that, you know, was impactful in the arts, you know.
Did you play sports in high school? Is that something you mentioned?
Yes, I did.
What did you play?
I played football, and I was a pole vaulter. I really enjoyed it. I actually still love football. I love the NFL, which is something a lot of people say is a little uncharacteristic of me. But yeah, I was actually captain for the freshman team.
I would never have guessed it. And you know, it's not it's not like, it's just because a lot of the creatives, you know, in our circles are not really sports people.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I don't know what that reason, you know, never thought about it, but a lot of us are not into sports. And to be captain of the freshman football team is a big, it's a big deal. What high school did you play for?
I went to Katala High School in Anaheim.
That's yeah. right in the heart of
yeah.
Orange County. Yeah.
Orange County, you know,
and that's a big football community, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, unfortunately we weren't very good, but you know, it was fun to do it while I was there. And, you know, I did feel like, well, interestingly, there were actually a lot of Asians at our school, you know? And so, and so it was when we were playing, there were other Asian guys, you know, that were a part of the team, you know. We also had a lot of Latinos, you know, and so it's Southern California, you know, it's kind of, you know, unavoidable. I mean, this is in the 80s, but it was still like there was a large Asian, like some of my best friends were Asian, you know, growing up. But I still had, you know, the common Asian American identity crisis, you know, or having a journey to understanding who I was as an Asian American and a Vietnamese American. That's definitely something that ended up happening. You know, I did feel like there were others around me that looked like me. And some of them were really popular. Like my sister was super popular. She was a cheerleader and, you know, all that stuff, you know? So it was, So I might have a different experience than others that might have lived in places that were predominantly white, say, you know? We all still had the crisis, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think of these big football schools like Modern Day and, you know, Edison High and, you know, all these big high schools in OC that send their guys to, you know, collegiate sports. But so how do you go from being, you know, football player to what the transition from football player to a dramatic arts major at UC Santa Barbara?
Yeah. Well, I have always been influenced by theater and storytelling and particularly film, you know. I was in denial that that's what my career path was going to be, you know. I would go from, you know, football practice to rehearse at the school musical, you know? And so I've always divided my time, you know, in those two areas. I soon realized that also I wouldn't have been able to become a professional football player. You know, I was just too small, you know? And to be quite honest, I had more drive in telling stories than I was to become an athlete, you know? To me, it was kind of like there was an epiphany that happened in college that was kind of like, you know what, you know, you really should pursue the things that you are passionate about, you know, and that was storytelling, you know, and it first started in the theater because at the time I didn't think that I could make movies, you know, like. That was such a huge pipe dream, you know? I never thought that would ever happen. And I never saw anybody who was like me making movies, you know?
When did that all change? When you're like, I think I can write or direct something.
I started doing it in college, you know? And I started, you know, first in theater and I took a class in dramatic writing and, you know, it was a life calling. I found what I wanted to do, you know, and I started creating, you know, dramatic pieces and comic pieces, actually, for the theater for primarily Asian American actors, you know.
Right.
And we ended up, you know, creating things together.
Was there any traction as you're writing these pieces? I mean, because the gatekeepers are not, at that time, probably not paying attention to
No, there wasn't any traction. You know, I'll be very honest with you. I wrote a play called Monster, and it premiered at East West Players, and also did readings around the country, and it was, and I ended up getting an agent because of this play. And so my agent had submitted it to the Sundance Theater Lab. And I ended up meeting with Michelle Satter, actually, who's the director of the Sundance Institute's, I believe it's right now, she's the head of the labs and our artists' services, I believe. But I spoke to her and she basically said, hey, have you thought of like rewriting this and adapting this to a screenplay? And I was like, huh, I hadn't, you know? And so I went away and a year later, I had a screenplay adaptation of my play. And they said that I got into the screenwriters lab, you know, the Sundance Screenwriters Lab. And that's how things started to kind of roll, you know, right, for me. But, you know, I ended up getting a manager, and at the time, this was like early 2000s. And at the time he was sending it out to everybody, and the response from people is, we like your writing and all that stuff, but you have a Vietnamese American lead. There's no way we can get this financed. You know, and there's no way, you know, Hollywood is going to finance a film, and a rather large film, because it encompasses also the Vietnam War, that deals with a lead that is Vietnamese American.
Right.
And that was consistent. This was a consistent note that and response that we got from all the studios, actually. So. You know, I voiced my frustration to other Asian American creators and filmmakers, and we decided that, you know, we would try to do it on our own, you know, independently, you know. And we didn't want to have permission anymore. We didn't want, you know, and so we ended up trying to make our own films, you know.
You know, during those years, the early 2000s, I remember always thinking to myself that, of course, we're not going to get a chance to make our own films here in the U.S., you know, Vietnamese American or Asian American themes, or put our faces on screen, because we are such a small fraction of the population. The representation is, it's going to be hard to have people buying in, you know, theatrical ticket sales to support a project that has a big budget like that. So all of that is logical for me as I was growing up. And perhaps today, obviously, it's a very different landscape. But what do you think really kind of changed that? What is the evolution of all that, starting from those early 2000s to today? What do you think created all of this change?
Well, I think that, you know, one of the factors, I think, is because the leadership has changed. You know, I think that people started to, like, particularly Asian Americans are starting to become some of the gatekeepers, you know, people who, you know, have grew up just like us wanting to see Asian American projects or films and representation on screens and in the media became those people who were making the decisions, you know. And I think it took a little bit of time for us to actually have, you know, get to that level in which we could actually impact
right.
the industry in general, you know. You know, the first waves of immigration, you know, and migration to the United States, we're just here to survive, right? You know, we're here to, it again, like I was saying, it's like a pipe dream for us to actually work in the arts or in entertainment, you know. We're not encouraged to do that. Once we get into a position where there's more of us, another thing. That's another thing is that
right.
yeah, there are more Asian Americans in the United States than ever before. And so there's an audience. So the audience builds, right? And the gatekeepers become the people, you know, Asian Americans become gatekeepers. And so our stories are actually understood in, for the first time, you know, and they're willing to actually have us tell the story rather than other people like white folks tell our stories, you know. We are now becoming more educated in the, you know, in the industries in which we are working in, you know. So for instance, now parents are allowing us to go into cinematography, allowing us to go into fashion, you know. Perhaps it's because we become a little bit economically stable, you know. I'm not saying that there aren't Asian Americans that are below the poverty line. There's absolutely a lot of people who are still living the struggle, you know, and that is definitely real. But the more of that, the more of us who are establishing ourselves in not only economically but in the American psyche, you know, it makes our stories more available. You know, it's people are more open to it.
Right. Well, I want to segue here. Congratulations on your signing with Cinetic Media for management.
Thank you.
You know, it's all over my Facebook feed, and it's so wonderful, so heartwarming to read it, you know, to see
Thank
it.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask you, just for our listeners and our audience, what is the difference between having, you know, a manager, an agent, or a lawyer? I mean, they're all very different roles, but they're kind of like sometimes they overlap. And I want to hear, I kind of know, but I would love to hear it in detail. What the difference is and why it was such a big deal for you to sign with Cinetic.
Yeah. So a manager will be there for your whole career, you know, or at least for all of the different projects in which you are working on. You could be working on a television show and you can be working on a feature film, and your manager will guide you in the process of making those things happen, you know. Agents are generally we'll do things project by project, you know. So let's say I have a project that is a feature film that they can sell, you know, and so those things are a little different, you know, as far as like, you know, your career longevity is going to be your manager, you know, and sometimes it's your agent, but depending on your relationship, but generally speaking, your manager is the person that's right next to you throughout your career. They'll help you guide your career too, you know? You know, and agents can, I've had agents for specific projects, you know? So for instance, you know, there was an agent that sold the rights to The Housemaid, you know? And so I no longer have a relationship with that person after that was done.
Right. You know?
And a lawyer is so necessary, I have to say. I've had my lawyer for a long time, 15 years or something like that. They are the ones that actually advise you on the legal side. So they will help you with their own, you know, they normally, entertainment lawyers have other clients that they can, you know, make rendezvous and introductions and all that stuff, but primarily they are ones that are help you with contracts and negotiations and all of that type of stuff. Obviously, they will be working with your manager and your agent at the same time on specific projects, you know. So they all function in rather different ways, but they overlap, you know. And so a lot of times people get a little confused by that. But
I ask you that to lead into the next thing, which is you are you write and direct in different mediums, podcast, film, plays. So there's just so much overlap in that. And I wanted to kind of segue again. You the most recent thing that you wrote and direct is Burning Bayou, which I listened to the first the pilot episode and I loved it. What was the inspiration for that?
Well, I mean, there were two inspirations, actually. My mother was a district attorney investigator in Orange County. And she was one of the very few women that at the time who, you know, completed the police academy and also like one of the, I think the only woman of color to actually have done that and became an investigator. So as I was growing up, you know, she actually had to work with a lot of Vietnamese gangs, you know, and so there was a lot of, we talked about that a lot. And I was always fascinated by her life as a, you know, a Vietnamese refugee, and now, you know, is a district attorney investigator in Orange County, you know? And that journey has always been interesting. So I lived around this, you know, lived around this consciousness of investigations and law enforcement and what the cracks in law enforcement. Yeah. And so I always am very interested in exploring that. The second inspiration was that was a case that was out of Seadrift, Texas. And I learned about this quite a while ago, but and I've always been fascinated by it. But basically, it was a case in which there was a pretty much a race war between Vietnamese refugees in the Gulf who were recently arrived in the United States. This is during the early 80s, during the recession. And as you might know, the US government, once, you know, Vietnamese refugees were coming into the United States, they were spreading Vietnamese communities everywhere.
Right.
And they felt like the Gulf area was a good area to bring some recent refugees because Vietnamese people are really good. Sorry, Vietnamese people are really good at fishing and shrimping. And so what ended up happening was that there was an influx of refugees, and because of the recession, the local laborers felt threatened by it.
Right.
You know, it's very similar to what was happening in Detroit, you know, in the Vincent Chin, you know, murder, where, you know, basically white Americans were just saying, hey, you know, the Asians are coming in order for us to keep our economic advantage, we need to stand up against them, you know? Right. And so it ended up becoming pretty violent. And the, you know, what ended up happening was the laborers actually ended up recruiting the KKK, you know? And so there were cross burnings on Vietnamese houses and lawns and, you know, and threatening, you know, threatening messages in the Vietnamese community by these laborers. And so I wanted to talk about this, but I wanted to also, you know, relocate it. Because there was actually a film by Louis Malle that was called Alamo Bay back in the 80s. But one of the things that when I saw it, it's about this area and about what was happening there. But the film was really focused on the fishermen, the white fishermen, you know, and didn't really.
Interesting.
Yeah, it didn't. I kind of got frustrated by that, you know, even though there was I think he made a conscious effort, and he's an amazing filmmaker, by the way, I think that he was really trying to get the Vietnamese perspective on that, but I'm sure the Hollywood execs were like, no, we need to really focus on the white folks, right? And so for me, it was my way of talking about this in a way that is in the perspective of the Vietnamese American, you know?
Why the podcast form and not film or play?
Right, well, I'll definitely tell you that I love podcasts. And one of the things that is a challenge for a project like this is that the leads are people of color, you know, the one character, the main characters, one is a Vietnamese American woman who is a rookie FBI agent, you know, and the other is an African American veteran of the FBI. And he actually was trained in Vietnam to speak Vietnamese and to know the Vietnamese culture. So they're assigned this particular case. And I also relocated it to outside of New Orleans, which is a very large Vietnamese American community.
Right.
And so for me, and with the advice of all of my reps, it's a hard sell, you know. It's a period, you know. It doesn't have the conventional, you know, leads that could green light a series, you know. It's a little expensive, you know. And I was speaking to the Starfish Accelerator, which is a nonprofit that has basically, what they do is they create, for people of color and artists of color, they finance or fund, they're proof of concepts,
right,
for larger pop culture works. So it could be a TV show or a feature, or it could be large, you know, art installations. So they were, I got a grant through them, and they have been supporting this, the production of the pilot. So now what we'd like to do is release the pilot, which we are doing now, and seeing and proving to people that there is an audience, you know. And from there, we're hoping to expand the pilot into a full podcast season and or a television show, you know.
Got it.
But it was very methodically,
right, strategic.
It was strategic.
Very strategic.
In trying to, yeah.
You know, I have in my notes the agent, the African-American male agent, Matt Watson. He says, if I didn't join a gang, I wouldn't be here. And it really resonated with me, because I was thinking, like, what writer thinks about that? Like, you have to understand it from the other side to write a line like that. And the reason it triggered me is because it shows empathy for wayward teens or people who've gone down that route, and there's redemption at the end of it, perhaps. I mean, just in that one line, that's what I got personally, what I got from it, because we don't get to hear men of color sort of voice that perspective often. And it really hit me, and I thought that was, but now I kind of understand, or I kind of have a clue of, like, that being exposed with your mother as a DA.
Yeah.
But I don't know, I'm just extrapolating here.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, there are communities where it is difficult to, it is difficult to protect yourself and your family without, from other gang members, without, you know, joining a gang yourself, you know. And I'm not saying that it is the right thing to do, you
right.
know, but I think that it is a reality for some people in the world. And I didn't want, the thing is that for me, I didn't want to demonize the gang members. You know, there had to be, there's a reason why gangs exist, you know. Usually they're from disenfranchised, lower economic standing citizens, you know? And the only way they might feel that they have power or they have a say, you know, in their surroundings is to band together, you know? And so it's in some ways, you know, I was just trying to see if other people can see that perspective, you know? And otherwise, you know, people get whacked, you know, and people
yeah.
get intimidated. People get extorted, you know. Again, these are not things that I champion at all, but I can definitely see the other side, you know, and why gang members exist, gangs exist. And especially during the 80s, especially recent immigrants, it's usually recent immigrants, right? And so, I, I wrote that in there because, you know, Mac, as a former gang member, can actually investigate the gang activity in the case in a personal way. You know, in a lot of ways, these characters are going through a lot of personal identity stuff, and their journey is through this case. You know, Cheryl Carter is going to understand what it means to be a Vietnamese American. You know,
right? Very interesting juxtaposition. I really enjoyed Matt Watson. You know, reminds me so much of Samuel Jackson and. Mm-hmm. But Chantal Thuy did an outstanding job. You know, shout out to Chantal.
She's amazing. You know, and I think that she's going to have an amazing career. I hope to work with her again. You know, I think that she has an amazing voice. That's another thing is that when you listen to her on the podcast, there's something very, it really catches your attention, you know, and her levels and the way her inflections are really dynamic. So, which is why I was very interested in working with her on this.
Yeah, she's perfect for the role. I mean, you can feel the disconnect from being Vietnamese through the way she carries herself. And it's very, you know, it's very, very cool to listen to her and not see her on the screen because, you know, we're used to seeing her and she's yeah. done quite a few, she's been in TV and film now for quite some time. So I want to ask you about this. This is something I wonder about all the time. Properties like the stuff that we create for ourselves. The hard part is getting the word out. Is the marketing part of it. What is the plan for a podcast like this? Like, do you make it and you just leave it to somebody else to do? Or is it something that you have to
I wish. You know, being a creator nowadays, it's a lot of it has yes. to do with how you engage with the communities and your audience, you know? I am trying to bring this out to, you know, many different communities. I get help from other nonprofits, and it's a really grassroots like effort to try to bring this to audience members. You know, we're looking at primarily like Asian American and people of color as target audiences, and also women, because you don't see a lot of women leading a thriller, you know, a crime thriller, you know, and so. Those are the ways in which we're trying to capture our audience, you know, and it's a team, you know, and many creators have to be a part of the effort, because nowadays who tells the story is just as important as what the story is.
Right. Completely understand. Yeah, agree with that. It's very difficult if you don't understand the marketing machine of the entertainment business going into the business, because that's like such a big component of how things get greenlit or even the success of something that we spend so many years trying to develop and figure out. And finally you get it and it's, you know, you get it out there, but you know, you don't understand the numbers behind the product.
Yeah, I mean, the reality is that I also work as a producer, you know, and I have to think about those things when I take on a project that I've created myself, you know, and think pretty deeply about what I'm trying to say. Is there an audience for it? And sometimes I say, fuck it, I'm going to do it anyway, you know. But with this one, I think that it is going to be a collective, you know, effort to try to get it out there. And especially since the audience is going to help us get it greenlit for other iterations, for the whole season and for the television show. And I'm hoping that that's, and you know, it's difficult and it takes a lot of effort, you know. Sometimes it's my least favorite part of it because I feel uncomfortable promoting myself, you know, but everybody who's talking about it is like, you know, you're also doing it for the artists that are involved in the project and you want everybody to also bear witness to their artistry and creativity.
Oh my God, I totally feel you on that, promoting for ourselves. It's just the hardest thing. I talked to so many of our,
yes,
the humility aspect of it, where we're trying to keep in that, you know, that humble mode, but at the same time, if we don't do it, nobody hears about it. And it's just so cringy to me to have to go through that exercise of getting the word out. That's the least favorite part. I love sitting here. I can sit in interviews the entire day, but to go out and market it, I don't mind having a team doing it, but when it comes to me having to kind of keep proclaiming certain things, it's just so uncomfortable.
I feel you. And I think that it's how we might be raised. You know, I think that at least for my family, and, you know, for other Asian American families that I know, or folks that I know, it is improper to promote yourself, you know, and to have, and the humility is a part of our upbringing. It's a part of, and especially as immigrants, when we are told to kind of like, you know,
tone it down,
you know, just be a part of the wave and not ruffle any, rock the boat at all, that it's against our, it's against our upbringing.
Cultural values. Yeah.
Yes. And our cultural values to, you know, promote yourself and say, you know, I'm great. but I do get constantly reminded that it's not only about promoting myself, but it's also about the piece itself, and about, you know, I will go to bat for Chantal and Keir and all of the other actors and artists in the podcast, but I'm just less comfortable doing it about myself, you know?
Yeah. Well, I want to talk a little bit more about yourself.
okay.
I'm going to go harder here. I want to know about your time, because you have a lot going on. You have population, you have writer, you have director, you have a lot of hats that you wear. Can you give me a breakdown on how all of that works in your day?
I'm an ox. I'm a zodiac ox, and they say that oxen, all they do is they're hard workers and they love to work. And I do. I love to work. Mm. You know, I work on weekends. I work at night. You know, a good thing is that I don't have kids, you know.
Right.
And so that doesn't take a lot of my time. So my creations, like my plays and my films, are my kids, you know. And so I devote a lot of that time to them, you know. The good thing is that, you know, I don't feel that work is work. I love it, you know. And I don't drag myself to work, you know. I actually get excited about, you know, going in and trying to make something happen, you know. So a day is pretty much, it changes all the time, because whether I'm in production or whether I'm producing something or whether I'm writing something, you know, in the end, I just kind of like, I just pretty much think ahead and hoping that this story will resonate to somebody, you know, and that somebody, hopefully people will learn, and I'm giving opportunities for other people's voices to be heard and all of those type of things. I just think of the macro, you know, and I have to work a lot, you know, but I enjoy it. So it doesn't feel like work, you know?
And I think that's important.
The population, I co-founded with Minette Louis and Molly Asher. And so we are producing works by underrepresented, you know, artists and filmmakers, and we're doing TV and film and podcasts, and, you know, our newest podcast, our newest feature film, Catch the Fair One, is coming out February 11th. And we just, it won a couple awards at Tribeca last year, and it's going to be released theatrically and on demand by IFC Pictures, IFC Films, whom I love. They're amazing. They distributed The Housemaid in the US, so I think they're just amazing. And so you just keep going, you know, you just keep going, and you a day in the life for me changes every day.
Right. I really enjoyed The Housemaid when it came out. It was awesome. Tell me about, like, that was your first film in Vietnam.
Yeah.
What was that experience like?
Well, it was incredible, actually, you know. I was fortunate enough to go back to Vietnam to make a film that's loosely based on my grandmother, you know. And I had the privilege to work with amazing producers, you know, Timothy Bowie and, you know, the folks at CJ Entertainment and HK Films. It was a film that I felt was deeply personal, you know, and although people say it's a horror film, to me, it's actually a gothic romance. They didn't know how to market a gothic romance, whether in Vietnam or internationally. They were like, I don't know how to do this. But I wanted to talk about colonialism, you know, and how I used ghosts as a metaphor for how colonialism actually stays with a culture even after the colonizers leave, you know? And so, and I wanted to do it in a way that's entertaining, you know? That's one of the things that's kind of like my motto is that I want to say something, you know, whether it is political or sociological or whatever, but also have it in a entertaining way, you know? And so for me, The Housemaid was a film that was about colonialism, but actually was a ghost story, you know, and actually was a love story, you know.
And how was it inspired by your grandmother?
Well, so she loved to tell ghost stories. You know, she believed that ghosts lived in trees. So for instance, and so when I was growing up, I was kind of like, whoa, there's spirits in the trees. And then when I went to Vietnam, I saw all of these, you know, orchards, those rubber plantations. And I learned about the brutal punishments and conditions in which the Vietnamese workers had to endure as indentured servants to the French, you know, French plantation owners. And I thought that that was a really interesting way to talk about that history, but in a horrific, and also not back away from the horrific things that were happening to us, you know, to the Vietnamese workers. And so I decided to make something that was unflinching about that, you know, but at the same time, you know, my grandmother was also a housemaid. So all of those type of things who ended up falling in love with the head of the household. So there was a lot of, those were the bits of inspiration. It's fictional, you know, and that's another thing that I like to do. I just look at real life situations, stories, and then fictionalize them, you know, and see how I can create something that is not only entertaining, but also has something to say, you know, within this, the real stories, you know. It also gives me liberty the freedom to mold the narrative, which might be better for entertainment purposes or just storytelling, you know.
And was your grandmother a housemaid for French colonial?
No, she was not actually. No, she was actually a housemaid for an upper class Chinese Vietnamese family.
Wow, so she must have so much to say, so many stories.
Yeah.
And this is your mother's mother?
So it's actually my father's family. So okay. Yeah. So there was a lot of a lot of my father's family was from the north, even though we are southern, you know. And so, but when we speak, it's a mixture of both Vietnamese, northern and southern dialects, mainly southern, but, you know, I call my mom Mẹ, you know, and I call my dad Bo, you know. So
right.
It's a mix. Yeah. So it's, yeah.
And I understand Housemaid is being made into an American film right now, right?
Yeah. So you know, I spoke with my producer, Timothy Bowie, and I had, during my research, I was noticing a lot of the parallels that was happening in Vietnam's plantations and the conditions there and some of the conditions in the US, you know, and particularly in the plantations in the South. And so I pitched this and to you know, him and then to CJ Entertainment. And however, one of the things that I was adamant about is that this was an African-American story. This is an important thing about in Black history in America, and that I would not be the one who's directing it. I would not be the one who is going to primarily write it, you know. I was here to hopefully tell some truths from another culture, you know. And so we have Deion Taylor as the director, you know. He's an incredible director, and then we have a, you know, a team of writers, including myself. Actually, I did co-write it with one of the with Jeffrey Fletcher, who won the Oscar for writing Precious.
As well. Wow, it's an amazing team.
Yeah, and so at the moment we're trying to get this together. We have a script and we're going out to cast and everything. But as you know, with COVID, things have been very difficult, you know. And so, and you know, the subject matter is it's also a horror film. It's much more a horror film than the original. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's called Grave Hill. And you know, we're trying to make that happen this year, you know.
I'm excited for that. I'm very excited. Yeah. to see the translated version of that.
It's very different, which is what I encouraged everybody to do is that don't even think about the original, you know, and just go with the basic, you know, basic storyline or as inspiration. And they really did. It's very, very different, you know, and that's what I like about it and applaud about it, you know, that it's because the culture is just different, you know, right. and we have to be, you know, we have to be true to the stories and how they are manifested in different ways, you know, and how these stories are told. So,
yeah, this sort of, meaning the colonial expression coming out from The Housemaid, the original, that you're using Housemaid as a vehicle to kind of express this idea of colonial and how it stays with us. Are you doing the same thing with Grave Hill? Are you you know, doing some sophisticated horror like Get Out in that vein?
That's our hope. Yes, and you know, to compare anything to Get Out is amazing because it's like there's definitely a political undertone in it, but again, it's like it is a horror film. It is a romance too, actually. And so, if you get the underlying meaning, great, you know. But I think that on anybody could experience it in any different level. And multiple levels is actually ideal, right? You know, that
right.
One is entertained by it, and then after leaving it, one either starts, it ignites a discussion, or you learn something from it, you know?
What do your parents think of your career so far?
God, I don't know. I think my dad has passed, but he was actually pretty supportive, you know. He always kind of like was, you know, Derek, do your thing, you know. And it took a while for that to happen, you know. But you know, he was always very curious about what I was doing, and I think he was pleased that we were that I was telling Vietnamese stories, you know. So for me, I think that I just think of that and I'm just like, I am so fortunate. You know,
you are so fortunate
to have, parents that were support. That was supporting me.
Did he ever get to see The Housemaid?
Yes, he did. He did. And he liked it. I think that he, I think that there are times when he doesn't know how to express what he got from it, you know? I didn't actually ask him too much about it because there was a part of me that was kind of like, oh, maybe he hated it. So I didn't want to dig deeper. So I just allowed him to lead the conversation.
Yeah.
But he said that he liked it, you know, which is enough for me, really. My mom has always been very supportive, you know, of my career. She advised me on Burning Bayou. You know, I often call her and ask her about it because she's lived some of this, you know. And so she's very supportive, and she says she's proud of me more often than I even asked for, you know. So I'm blessed, and I know that I'm very fortunate.
Sometimes I wish I can put together a quantifiable poll across cultures to see who's got the fucking best mothers. And I feel like the Vietnamese, we yes. have the best mothers, but I can't say that like on a scientific, on a, you know, like some quantifiable way, but like my mom, in terms of support and in terms of just giving it 100% to my brother and I, I don't know if that's a Vietnamese thing or that's just a mother to son thing.
Yeah. I do think that there's something about, particularly Vietnamese American mothers, you know, because a lot of the mothers that I know has gone through a lot for their kids, you know, wars and escape and, you know, all of these type of things that they don't take it for granted, you know?
Yeah.
You know, and I think that there's something about that, you know, that, and the thing is that I find Vietnamese American women to be very strong, you know, and I think that there's something about that that translates to being amazing mothers.
Yes, you know? Yes. You know, I was telling my mom in a car ride yesterday, I said, I know a lot of Vietnamese American men my age, and I don't know one of them that hates their mother or has a bad relationship.
Yeah.
It's hard to find. I'm sure they're out there, but you know, making a huge. And then I said to her, I followed up with, I don't know one of these guys that have a good relationship with their fathers.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's this whole thing about mother daughters, mother sons, fathers daughters, right?
Yeah.
And this is like all over all cultures, right? I surprisingly actually had a great relationship with my father. You know, towards the, you know, like at the beginning, it was a little trying, but I think that, you know, he started to really understand me a little bit more. And I think that particularly after I came out to him, you know,
right.
And I was just being much more honest about who I was and all that stuff. And so for him, I think that he started to really appreciate that I was, you know, inviting him into my reality. You know, and who I am. And ever since then, and this was many years ago, ever since then, we had a better relationship because I think we understood, you know, each other on a very intimate level, you know.
Was your situation with your parents one of where it was a complete surprise to them, or they knew and it just was just not spoken about?
So My parents are divorced, was divorced and remarried, you know? And so their reactions were a little different, you know? When I came out to my mom, I was much younger than when I came out to my dad, you know? And my mom guessed it. So I was like, okay, so she kind of guessed it. She knew, you know? So,
yeah.
But with my dad, I had to actually tell him, you know? And I think it was a combination of just not, of denying it, you know, and or not even wanting to acknowledge it at first, you know. Although I told him, we didn't talk about it for a long time, like for years, you know. And then when he finally, you know, when we finally were able to talk about it, you know, I think it took him years to really right. understand, you know. And as an immigrant man, you know, wanting to, you know, and especially an Asian man, a Vietnamese man, you know, we're constantly demasculinized, you know, we're constantly being seen as weak, you know. And I think that those are things that he carried with him when I came out to him, you know. And I think that after a while, he started to understand that, you know, being gay isn't a weakness, and it wasn't like being effeminate, really, you know. And I think that really kind of like changed our relationship, you know. He's very supportive of my husband. You know, I've been with my husband for 22 years now, you know. And so, you know, my mother, you know, is very, in, you know, very, just loves my husband. I think that all kind of helped in our relationship, because I can finally kind of like be honest with them, you know.
Yeah, you sound like you have super supportive and progressive parents.
Yes, but not all of my family is that, you know. And I think that that's what made me appreciate them more, that they were willing to just kind of go, well, I don't give a fuck what you say, what you're saying or what you think, you know. And I think that that is what, again, drew us closer.
Do you have projects coming up in Vietnam?
I have an idea for a project, and it's quite large in scope. I can't tell you about it, though.
No problem.
Yeah, it's something that I have been mulling over for probably 10 years now. You know, it was an idea that I had before The Housemaid, you know. But it's something that I've been, I think that I'm not in the position, I'm not where I should be in my career to make this thing happen as far as my being the director of it. So I am waiting and gestating. You
know? How do you know that? Like, how do you know where you are in your career to make, I mean, I think mm-hmm. I know the answer, but I would like to hear and explore it out loud by you talking about that. What does that mean?
It means that I want to have more experience as a director to take on a project at this scope, you know? And I think that I feel like I can do it. I don't know if other people will give me the opportunity to do it just yet, and the way that I want to do it, you know. And so I'm trying to be patient, you know. I'm trying to look at the, you know, ahead, and get myself in a position where I can also have my creative freedom in it too, you know, because it's not a project that's going to, it's a studio project. It would have to be a studio project because of the budget, you know? And so those are things that I am considering, you know. It doesn't mean that I'm not working on it. It doesn't mean that, and hopefully maybe I'll make it next year.
Right.
But one of the things that I like to tell many stories, I'm like one of these people that I never get writer's block, you know? I'm always constantly, I have a creating. Database of yeah. stories that I want to tell, you know? And whenever I have an inspiration, I write it down, you know, and I put it in this database, you know? And now it's like hundreds of entries, you know? Most of them are bad. Well, be very honest, most of them are bad, you know? But at least I wrote it down and I'm able to refer back to it if you know? I have the worst memory in the world, so that's why I write, you know, because then I feel like, you know, there's at least a document of it. I can refer back to it because there are times when I walk down the stairs and go, why did I walk down here for? So
That process of writing all of this bad stuff or all of this stuff just to file it away is part of the process. It's the part of the whittling down to get to what we need to get to make the other stuff shine. And many times they're affiliated and they have overlap too.
Yeah. I think it all just kind of overlaps, right? It's that learning process. It's how you get to that point, right? And then you become more discerning about what you want to do and how you want to shape your career, you know? Sometimes people just have a career and it wasn't planned, you know?
Yeah.
But, you know, I have not had that experience, you know? And I kind of, you know, have to figure out how to get there, you know? You know, it's like Lord of the Rings, you have to like get the map and you have to go through the forest and, you know, through the hills and all that stuff to get to Mordor, you know, and you have to be more methodical about it.
Yeah.
If you're lucky enough to actually just land in Mordor, that's great, you know, but.
Derek, thank you so much for that, you know, the honesty, because, you know, that makes a whole difference, you know, when young people listen to these kinds of podcasts where they can, you know, understand that it's not rosy. The journey in filmmaking and writing, directing, it's not easy. And things don't just come when you want them to come, and things sometimes come when you don't want them to, you know, they're just all over the place and you can't really track it. I want to ask you, where can we listen to Burning Bayou? What platforms is it available on?
Yeah, so it's on Spotify, it's on Google, but the easiest way is just to go to burningbayou.com, and it'll take you to all of the different platforms that it's available. And so we just released it, the pilot, and you know, so it's out there for free, and you know, we're hoping that you guys enjoy it.
Yeah, I loved it, and I hope everybody listens to it. It's wonderful, and let's you know, put some numbers behind it so we can get this whole series made, so we can all enjoy. I want to know what happens next.
I have the whole series in my head, so but thank you so much. It was great talking to you.
Thank you for coming on. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. The Vietnamese is produced by Brittany Tran. Special thanks to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Christo Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast. You can also find us on YouTube, where you can subscribe, like, and comment. Please rate and give us a review wherever you find our podcasts. Thanks again for listening.